Good evening, and welcome to the Hirshhorn Museum. I'm Valerie Fletcher. I'm the senior curator here, and I'll be the moderator for tonight's panel. This is not a formal academic kind of setting, so I would like to encourage those of you who may be at the back out of shyness or something, please come on down. This is meant to, there'll be questions and answers at the end. We'd love to have you just join in the conversation. I will make a few introductory remarks. I'll explain the sequence of what we're doing, and then we're just going to jump into it. First of all, would you please turn off your mobiles or put them on vibrate? Thank you very much. Secondly, I would like to thank various organizations that have made both this exhibition and this program possible. This is an exhibition, when one says an exhibition of five installation works, you think, oh, no big deal. But when you go see what these installations consist of, it's considerable. And so we'd like to thank the Latino Initiative Pool here at the Smithsonian, which provided the federal funding for the show. We'd also like to thank the David Bermont Foundation. We'd also like to thank the Embassy of Brazil, which funded the publication of the exhibition brochure, which is free, by the way, at the entrance to the galleries. And we'd also like to thank the Interdevelopment Bank for helping us fund tonight's program. We have the luxury of being able to talk in a fairly intimate setting with two of the artists in the supersensorial show and with the organizing curator, Almo Ruiz, and a little bit of me thrown in. I was the coordinating curator here with a particular passion. Aha. At any rate, what we're going to do is one person speak for each artist. Obviously, artists who are no longer with us. Alma will be talking, for example, about the earliest work in the show by Fontana. Then we will have Julio Laparque. Then we'll have Carlos Cruz Diaz. I will fill in for Soto because our esteemed speaker had a family emergency and had to be elsewhere tonight. And then we'll come back to Alma, who will talk about Oiticica. What we have in terms of visuals are we have some excerpts from videos that were done. These are much longer videos, documentaries on each of the artists. We're going to show a couple of excerpts, one for each artist, more or less. Some of them will have sound, some of them will have subtitles, some will be historical black and white photographs, some will be action shots in color of works other than those in the show. The goal is not just to talk about the individual works in the show, though we will do that, but it is also just to talk about what sparks, what motivated the creation of these works, and what experiences they engender in us. And so, let me just check and see. I keep forgetting I'm supposed to make certain formal remarks. I think I've got them covered. So, I would like to start by introducing our speakers. First of all, we have Almo Ruiz here on the left, who is senior curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. She has a long resume, as the senior curators tend to have, but she's here because she had the brilliant, in my opinion, brilliant idea of trying to do several things in one exhibition, either any one reason would have been enough. She wanted to, first of all, bring forward five artists originating from Latin America, various countries, and demonstrate that they were doing things in the field of what we now call light and space art. With a capital L and a capital S, that tends to mean Southern California art. And then you throw in a few other artists like Dan Flavin, based in New York. But the fact is the 1960s was a fascinatingly rich as well as turbulent period. And artists whom we don't necessarily have, you know, in the forefront today, were doing remarkable things then. And Alma wanted to show what Latin Americans contributed to this experimental approach to art that consists of light, color, and space. And so she's bringing these artists forward to get them into the canon. If you look at standard books on light and color space art, it doesn't tend to include these artists. And secondly, and I'm just effusive here because I know how hard it is from experience to do a thematic show and not just to have artworks that sort of do variations on the same theme. Instead, in this exhibition, we have a remarkable progression of different kinds of works. In date, they extend from 1951 to 1973, 74. But the fact is what they were doing at each of those dates was well ahead of their time, and the experiences that we get to have from them are different. What you experience from the Fontana is quite different from what you experience in the Cruz Diaz, and that's quite different from what you experience in the Soto. That's different from what you experience in the Le Parc, and so on with O.E.T. Sica. So Alma is going to do double duty tonight. She's going to be talking about the first and the last artists in the exhibition. She'll be talking about Fontana, and then at the end she'll be coming back and talking about O.E.T. Sica. Rather than introduce everyone up front, if you don't mind, I'm going to introduce each speaker as their turn comes up so we can focus on each one. I'm also a techno dummy, so we are going to let Alma come to the podium and do her own speaking from here, and she has visuals to go with it. Have I left anything else?
No.
Right. Okay, then. This is why I have people remind me of things, because I go to great troubles and then I forget to do it. The Fontana video, for artists who couldn't be here, we just have little excerpts from the videos to give you an idea. Further ado, it's my great pleasure to introduce Alma Ruiz.
Well, thank you for being here. It's a real pleasure to be in Washington and to be at the Hirshhorn, so I appreciate the opportunity to bring Supersensorial to Washington, D.C. And also would like to thank the Hirshhorn Museum, its trustees, director, curators, staff, all of whom worked very diligently in making the exhibition happen, and especially Valerie, because we've taken over her life this week, and before that too, in setting up the exhibition, and now with the artists and me here, she's had no time to do anything else but think about us 24 hours a day. So anyways, I'm going to start with Fontana. As you saw that video, you saw how Fontana went from making sculpture, which sort of looked quite traditional, to making these amazing constructions using neon. And this is so interesting about this person who led a rather interesting life. Here we have a picture of him in Milan in the courtyard of his studio there, of his atelier. And Fontana actually was born in 1899, and he's quite a bit older than the other artists in the exhibition. He was born in Argentina in a town called Rosario, which is actually known for its large Italian community. And spent a few years there before his father, who was Italian, took him to Italy for schooling. But throughout his life, he kept going back and forth between Italy and Argentina, and he actually spent what I consider two of the most important periods of his life in Argentina. When he was about 22 years old, he was going to art school in Milan, and he sort of became homesick and decided, wrote his father saying, I want to go back to Rosario. You know, I really don't know what I'm doing yet, and I want time to think about what I will do in the future. And he returned to Rosario and trained in his father's sculpture shop. His father made commercial sculpture, but he also participated in some competitions for public monuments. And so he spent quite a few years working along his father in the sculpture workshop and trained as a traditional sculptor. And that was very good because he learned to use all the tools rather well. And then at the end of several years, he decided he really wanted to be an artist, and he went back to Italy to finish art school. And then again in the early 1940s, that was in the 20s, and then in the early 40s, he probably decided that he would rather spend the war years in Latin America, and he went back to Rosario. But Rosario wasn't the same for him anymore, and he felt it was kind of a small town, so he left Rosario after a few months and settled in Buenos Aires because that's where everything was happening. The early to mid-40s in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, it was a very exciting place to be. Artists were very much into creating new art. They formed groups, especially one that's very well known called the Madi Group. The Madi Group is very well known because they incorporated neon in their work, and they also broke the square. They made shaped canvases, and they were very active in organizing exhibitions and in organizing discussions and so on. So for Fontana, that was the place to be. He was friends with this artist, who, it's interesting, you know, most of these artists sort of lean towards the left, and actually Fontana had been part of a fascist, you know, movement in Italy. But there seems to have been this transformation about Fontana when he sort of went from the right to the left, because the artists that he was interested in associating with, the people he was interested in getting to know and having discussions with, you know, thought else slightly different. They didn't want to be part of the establishment. And he also taught in two art schools in Buenos Aires, and actually Julio Leparc, whom we have here tonight, was one of his students there. He was quite young. Julio had started art school quite when he was in his teens, and had an opportunity to study with Fontana. So having said this, most of you are familiar with Lucio Fontana as an Italian artist. And also, this is the kind of work that you have seen, you know, what he called the concetto spaziale, or the spatial concept, in which he actually cut the canvas, he slashed the canvas, in order to gain contact with the space beyond, you know, with the space beyond. And this is what, you know, made him well known afterwards, and also with, you know, works like this, in which, in addition to slashing the canvas, he punctured it, you know, and creating these beautiful compositions, a little rough, a little different, but certainly something that was of interest to him, you know, how to go beyond the plane, how to go beyond, you know, it's no longer a window, the painting is no longer a window, but he's going beyond that, creating a space, sort of investigating the space behind the canvas. But interesting enough, in 1947, he decides he wants to take a vacation, and he goes back to Italy, and for some reason he ends up staying and never goes back to Argentina. He settles in Milan His studio has been destroyed during the war, and he finds another place, and he recreates the same kind of environment he had in Buenos Aires, in the sense that he surrounds himself with friends, and he also writes manifestos the way he did in Argentina. And so in 1949, at a gallery in Milan called Il Naviglio, he makes the first environment with light. And this is kind of an awkward photograph of that particular work, because in order to take the photo, they had to illuminate the space. So you see these very strange forms hanging from the ceiling, which Fontana had made of paper mache and had illuminated with what is known as the Wood's light, the light that emits ultraviolet light. And so the idea was that you enter this dark space that was illuminated by this black light, and you momentarily lost the sense of where you were. You just couldn't tell, you couldn't move into space, and then little by little you adjusted to the light and you began to see these forms that were hanging from the ceiling. So this is in 1949, and it's the first kind of light environment that Fontana created. And of course, a couple of years later, he goes to create this amazing piece, which you now can see upstairs on the third floor, which he made when he was invited to participate in the 9th Triennial in Milan. Interesting enough, he created this piece as he did during this decade. For about 9 years, he created neon sculptures that were presented in public places in Milan and other cities in Italy, and also in two private apartments. And they were all to be temporary, except the private commissions. They were all to last a few months, and they were commissioned mostly by corporations. This one in particular was set in the lobby of a theater, and it was meant to be seen as you walk down the stairs or up the stairs. So here at the Hirshhorn, we were lucky that we could recreate that experience, almost recreate that experience for the public. But as you can see, this is a beautiful piece that consists of two elements, and one is light and the other one is space. And it's a drawing in space, and the idea of drawing in space was not a new one, but doing it with neon was. And of course, he was familiar with neon because he had seen artists use neon in Argentina, and I also understand that artists from Eastern Europe were also using neon in the 1940s, so there's a certain relationship there that many artists were interested in new materials. You know, for example, I have a quote from Fontana here who says, "Sculpture and painting are things of the past. We needed a new art form, art that's movement, art within space." And so this is another view of that particular piece in Milan in 1951. And this piece was destroyed a few months later, and ever since then, the piece has been recreated. And many, many years went by before it was done, but there seems to be an interest in this kind of installations by Fontana. You know, once one curator starts thinking about it somehow, another curator also comes up with the same idea. So now I think there are several curators who are looking at this particular period of Fontana in which he did neon installations. And this is, of course, what you have here at the Hirshhorn on the third floor. And you can see how different the piece looks depending on where you're standing up, what kind of perspective you have. Now, this is another piece that Fontana made in 1941 in which he was also experimenting with light. He was placing light behind his punctured paintings, as you can see, and trying to create this environment. This is from 1952, and it's a ceiling that he created also, a temporary installation in Milan, and the holes create display of shadows, and also you can see this kind of the ceiling, the shape of the ceiling is has these big curves, you know, and it's not a rectangle, it's not a circle, but it's kind of has this pattern of curves repeating throughout. And in 1953, he's invited by a company in Italy to create this ceiling for an auditorium, and he did it with both holes, if you can see. these photographs are really bad. And the interesting thing is that all this work was documented, of course, in the 1950s in black and white. And these are the only documentation that we have. And so the quality of the photographs is not as good as it could be. But here you see that he's punctured the ceiling and also added this kind of check marks made with neon throughout. And these pieces were meant to be spectacular. They were meant to create some kind of surprise and, you know, on the public. This was done for this Cedar Commit, which is a company, a corporation in Italy. And then the last piece that he made, which is rather, it's rather traditional, I think. It's a simple cube made of neon. And it was made for a theater in the city of Pesaro. It just hung from the ceiling, and it was made in collaboration with an architect. So this is another thing that Fontana did throughout this decade. He always collaborated with architects in creating all these installations. And then, of course, after 1959, which this what he called a lampadario, you know, this chandelier. For some reason, he stopped making neon sculpture and went back to painting and sculpture, as we know, you know, for the next 25 years or so until he died in 1968. So this is what I'm going to say about Fontana for now, and the next person is Julio Leparque. Thank you.
It helps to have the real experts talking, doesn't it? Now, before we move directly into Julio Leparque, I wanted to let you have a pretty good insight into, I think, what the sort of subtext for this panel is. There's no official title. Anyone can speak about whatever they like, and I'm encouraging the artists themselves to do so. But what interested me and why I wanted to organize this panel is because one hears in contemporary art occasionally these talks, it pops up when I was young, when I was middle-aged, and now that I'm getting beyond that, about how you bring art into life. Is art that is avant-garde, by definition, by its nature, elitist or not? Well, I've never thought it was. I don't come from an art background or a wealthy background myself. I figure people can do what I did. You walk into a museum and a work of art transforms your perceptions, in my case, my life. But what Alma did, and this is the second sort of theme of her exhibition, is that she was particularly attentive to the question of how these artists created art that would be seen perhaps in museums where they can be seen by a certain public, but also be seen in the streets, be seen in offices, be seen in airports, out on the streets, in a variety of venues where people who might not otherwise encounter avant-garde art would almost literally trip across it or walk under it or what have you. And so I asked Alma, and I must say, Alma, I didn't know about that photograph of the auditorium. Bingo, I'm going to borrow that. And so it's a little bit different for each artist, but I found this particularly wonderful how each one of them espoused what was the utopian goal of the early 20th century at the birth of modernism, that art is about being part of life. It isn't something you hang on the wall with an esoteric symbolism or in support of some religious, political, or other, you know, monetary hierarchy, but far beyond that. I'm now going to introduce Julio Leparque, and we're going to see a video first. In this case, a silent video. There are subtitles. Julio Leparque is an artist in whom I've been interested for some time, but he's not a household word, particularly in this country, and it's really a shame, I think, because his works are, in many ways, uplifting and even magical in their impact. And he's not someone who puts himself forward. He's a very a quiet man with a sometimes dangerous sense of humor. As I learned to my surprise when I first met him and visited his studio in Paris. One thing that you'll need to bear with us is that for the middle of this program, we are now going to be a bilingual program. You may notice that both Julio La Parque and Carlos Cruz Diaz are huddled together. That is because one of Carlos's grandchildren has very kindly offered to simultaneously translate when needed. Actually, Alma is going to probably translate for Julio, or however, somebody will translate, because Julio and Carlos will speak in Spanish, and I know that some in our audience are bilingual also with Spanish, so you'll hear both the Spanish and the English translation. And I want to thank Marina very much for being our translator. We co-opted her at the last minute, and she's very gracious. So let me begin by showing the video. And Julio is more comfortable answering questions. So I'm going to pose some questions, get some conversation going. The audience questions won't be till the end of the program, but I just wanted to let you know that this will be kind of a spontaneous, impromptu thing. And I'll be showing some images that may or may not have any connection to what we're talking about. So I might add two things. One, as a teacher at heart, I'm going to give you each a book that you might want to pursue if you want to know more about the individual histories of these artists and about their artworks. So For Fontana, you have this book, which is called Lucio Fontana, Venice, New York, published by the Guggenheim Museum in 2006. For Julio La Parque, and I love the cover, because so many of his works do that. You see, it makes reflections all the way at the back of the auditorium. It's simply called Le Parc Lumière, which is Le Parc Light. And it's subtitled his cinematic works, but they're not about film, as you will see in the next presentation. It's about action, movement, light in motion. And the video I'm about to start on the park was actually produced very recently, just last year, 2010, by Le Parc Studio and his sons. And that's another thing that's wonderful about the artists, is that working with them is a family affair. I got to know Yamil La Parque is in the audience, Cruz Diaz's daughter Adriana. When I was in Paris, I was surrounded in the apartment by their families. It's just a joyous communal way of functioning that hasn't the kind of separationist approach that too often happens in modern life. Excuse me while I catch up with the technology here. Now, first of all, welcome to our stage, Julio Le Parc. You were very gracious to invite me to your home 2 years ago, and I discovered a world of art that I had not known before. And I was wondering if perhaps you could start this evening by talking to us a little bit about what impacted you when you went to Paris, what made you want to become a co-founder of the Grave Group, and what some of your manifestations and actions were. We saw pictures in the video. They mean very little to our audience. Can you talk a little bit about what your goals were with Grave and some of the works you created in connection with the group there in the 60s?
Cinco, seis preguntas.
Sí.
Juntas.
Sí.
Esa es la traducción.
Do you want me to pick one or you pick one?
Al llegar a París, tenemos que hacer la traducción, ¿no? Al. Abo. Al. Al.
Al. When?
Llegar.
He arrived.
Ah.
In
Paris.
Paris.
En una semana.
In a week's time period.
Más o menos.
More or less.
El complejo que podía tener un latinoamericano.
The complex that a Latin American person could have.
Con relación a un centro tan importante internacional del arte.
Concerning such an important center of international art.
Como era París.
Such as Paris.
Sí. Desapareció.
Disappeared.
Ese complejo de inferioridad desapareció.
He didn't have a complex anymore as a Latin American person being in Paris, that is such an important cultural city. And he started another cultural movement.
No, iba recorriendo las galerías de París, los museos, lugares públicos que uno podía encontrar. Viendo el movimiento, visitando las escuelas de arte, era como una pequeña cura de desintoxicación.
He went to a lot of museums and art galleries and was impregnating himself from the cultural actuality at that time, and it was like a desintoxication cure for him.
Lo que yo llevaba en mi cabeza, que había estudiado, me había interesado en Argentina, no lo encontraba en París. Por ejemplo, yo fui inmediatamente a los museos y un cuadro de Mondrian, ni por broma. Mondrian ha vivido 20 años en París y en el Museo Nacional de Arte Moderno no había ni siquiera un pequeño cuadrito, absolutamente nada.
What he had, what he had in mind, what he had learned in Argentina, he thought, in art, art-wise, what he learned in Argentina, he thought he would find it in Paris, of course, and he was very disappointed to see that it wasn't the case at all. When he went to the museum, he hoped he would see at least a Mondrian art piece that he thought was really important, but he didn't see any, so he was really disappointed.
El director de la Escuela de Bellas Artes nos afirmaba que era una escuela de bellas artes moderna.
The director of the director of the fine arts school assured them that it was
director de la escuela nos afirmaba a nosotros que era una escuela que se enseñaba
arte moderno.
Arte moderno.
That he assured them that what they taught them there was modern art.
La prueba era permitir a los profesores que hablaran a sus alumnos hasta del impresionismo.
And the proof of that was that they allowed the teachers to teach their students to teach them art until the impressionism. Like that was the proof that it was modern art. What was the rest of the question about?
It doesn't matter, but I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about how you were a co-founder of a group that made such an impact in Paris in the 60s, the Groupe de Recherche d'Art Visuel. And I'm showing one of your largest works that you made in the 1960s that was exhibited. And already you have a clearly formed iconography. Your vocabulary for art is so strong. What brought you to this point by 1963 to create art like this? Tres o cuatro preguntas.
No, con relación al grupo que fundamos.
In relation to the group that I founded and co-founded in Paris.
Nosotros, pequeño grupo de amigos de la Escuela de Bellas Artes.
We were a small group of friends from the Fine Arts School.
Hicimos atravesar el Atlántico a la idea de discutir, de compartir, de tener ideas, de tener aspiraciones, de pensar cosas por irrealizables.
We wanted to cross the Atlantic to share ideas and dreams and ideals and to make things that wouldn't be able to be made.
Pudimos encontrar con la ayuda de Vasarely, que nos puso en contacto, unos jóvenes artistas.
And thanks to Vasarely, that put us in contact with young artists.
Para poder con ellos desarrollar una nueva práctica también de confrontación.
We could develop a new practice of confrontation, a new way of confrontation.
De participar en los pequeños encuentros que cada uno hacía.
To participate in each of each other's events.
De reflexionar sobre el papel o el rol del artista en la sociedad contemporánea.
To think about an artist's role in that time society, in society at that time.
De ver lo arbitrario del sistema cultural y de los métodos de difusión de la creación artística.
To see the arbitrary ways of culture at that time and the method of communication at that time, the methods of communication.
Y sobre todo hacer una reflexión sobre el papel que podría, que debería en ese momento tener el espectador.
And most of all, to think about the role that the audience, the spectator, had to have at that time.
El espectador era el elemento completamente ignorado del funcionamiento artístico.
The spectator until then was an element that was ignored at that time when it made part of the art piece, but at the time it was ignored that the spectator made part of it, was just ignored.
Y en esa vía las experiencias se fueron realizando, compartiendo y aspirando cada vez más a un trabajo colectivo en la cual la participación de cada uno se fundía y que fue tomando forma, ya sea en laberintos, sala de juegos, experiencias en la calle.
We're starting to share the same ideas and same point of views and collaborate in labyrinths and playrooms and outings together, etc.
Well, here's a question that I've been wanting to ask you but have been too hesitant to do so, if you can believe that. But I wanted to ask if when you started working, as you did in this work in the early 1960s, light has been your essential element in everything you create. And I was wondering how you came to focus on light rather than some other element in art, and second part of the question, did light have any particular meaning or symbolism for you?
No fue que un día me desperté y que dije, hoy voy a comenzar a trabajar con la luz.
It's not like I just woke up one morning and said, today I'm going to work with light.
Sino que llegué a trabajar con la luz, persiguiendo pequeños problemas, planteos que me hacía, experimentando con pequeños objetos.
I came to work with light, encountering many problems and experimenting with a lot of objects.
Tratando de multiplicar los colores.
Trying to multiply colors.
De ver la sucesión, la progresión. En base a secuencias que yo realizaba sobre una superficie y luego quise poner en evidencia la potencialidad de esos cambios, de esas posibilidades.
I saw the possibility of seeing sequences on surfaces, and I wanted to see all the possibilities I had to create sequences on surfaces.
Entonces esas pequeñas experiencias las hacía con pilas y con una lamparita pequeña. Pilas son la...
Pilas,
sí. Hasta que un día, a riesgo de mi vida, agarré la lámpara que estaba en la cocinita.
And I used little lamps and batteries, and one day I used a little lamp that was in my kitchen.
Y en esa actitud y comportamiento de experimentación, las posibilidades se fueron abriendo en un sentido y en otro, hacia el movimiento, hacia la desaparición de la forma, hacia la multiplicación de las imágenes, a la incorporación de los elementos exteriores, entre la relación de dos elementos, y en ese caso la participación mía quedaba un poco menos importante. Eran dos elementos que yo ponía en situaciones que iban a crear formas, iban a crear una situación donde la transformación era la evidencia. No es cierto.
With experimenting in mind, I came to be able to do sequences and see the importance of creating sequences, of mixing things, of making appear things. I realized that my participation in the art piece wasn't that important. It was the art piece and something else.
Que la obra podía ser autónoma y crear ella misma relaciones con el que se acercaba. Más que obra, nosotros llamamos experiencia.
That the art piece by itself was self-explanatory, that it was self-sufficient, and yes, the art piece became self-sufficient. I discovered that the art piece was self-sufficient.
Y con lo referente al final de la pregunta.
And regarding the end of the question.
Valerie.
Valerie.
Y jamás se me ocurrió querer transmitir, no solamente con la luz, sino con los diversos elementos que yo he utilizado, absolutamente ningún se dice. En español. Quiero decir que nunca se me ocurrió imponer al público una visión de lo que yo hacía, ni transmitir serenidad, ni angustia, ni.
I never thought to impose on the audience any. My speech. I never wanted to impose my my speech on anyone. I didn't want to convey to them any particular feelings of sadness or anything.
Esa libertad me parece importante para que el espectador pueda con diversos grados de participación, aportando lo que él pueda tener como particularidad como ser humano. ¿Está bien?
I thought that that freedom to feel whatever you want to feel in front of the art piece was very important, and that's what it makes the particularity of being a human being, and that's the most important, to have the freedom of to feel whatever you want to feel in front of an art piece.
Sobre todo que creo que en la mayoría de los casos de la producción artística, los artistas han vivido en la ilusión que estaban transmitiendo, ya sea un mensaje, ya sea una emoción, ya sea sentimientos o particularidades especiales.
Especially since these times, artists live in the illusion that they actually are conveying something, like some kind of feelings to people.
Y posiblemente vivieron 40, 50, 60 años produciendo una obra, creyendo que el público la iba a ver de tal manera, y como nunca se hubo ni se pudo hacer experiencia en ese sentido, y las veces que yo he asistido a experiencia, el desencanto del autor de una obra, por ejemplo, es tremendo cuando se enfrenta a un público y el público le vuelve lo que ellos están viendo, y ellos, en muchos casos, el artista, es imposible que ustedes vean cosas que yo no he puesto en la obra. Ustedes están obligados a ver lo que yo he puesto en mi obra, y si ustedes no lo ven es porque son unos ignorantes. Entonces esa actitud.
And what's pretty sad is that some of them have lived 40, 50, 60 years believing that they have conveyed something to the audience, something that they thought that they conveyed to the audience, and then are confronted with the audience and see that people didn't see it that way at all, and then people are going to tell the artist what they felt, and the artist is going to be, no, you're an ignorant, because that's not what I wanted you to feel.
Y en algunas corrientes artísticas, los artistas, para asegurarse de que el público va a recibir lo que él quiere que el público reciba, suelen poner carteles gigantescos explicando lo que el público tiene que ver en sus obras.
In some art fields, to make sure the audience gets what the artist wants to convey, sometimes he puts these big panels with what he wants the public to feel written in big letters.
Ya está. Tenemos que hablar 10 minutos.
You said 10 minutes.
Yes.
Ya controlar.
Julio, thank you. It's not a question of minutes, it's a question of how much you shared with us. Thank you. I would like to point out that there are very few opportunities to see the works of Julio Laparque in this country, and it's even difficult to see them in Europe. But if you have the chance to be in Paris a year from now, there will be a retrospective of his work. And there are other projects in the making. There is a foundation called the Daros Foundation, which has made the best collection of his works. And I just want to back up a minute to show you something. This work, you can see the size of it by the small figure in the background. This is a work that was installed in a contemporary exhibition, very much like the Fontana Neon piece was. This is in 1963. And finally, just within the last 15 years, some enlightened collectors, museums, and foundations are working to achieve his works again in monumental scale. This work, which you see in the photograph from 1963, exists again. It's now in a foundation collection. But I just mention this because so much of what we do, we think we're capturing history, but it's not really there. So with that, it's time to move on to Carlos Cruz Diaz. So we're going to come back and ask questions of Julio. I think I've never had a conversation with Julio that lasted less than an hour and a half. Three is more likely because he's fascinating to talk to. So, too, is Carlos Cruz Diaz. And now I would like to also share with you, with each of these two artists based in Paris, I went to visit also the home and studio of Carlos Cruz Diaz one time, and it wasn't enough, so I had to go back another time. And I'm amazed that the conversations were trilingual with at least four or five family members. He showed me every corner of his studio, his workshop, his archive. And always we were laughing. So we spoke in three languages brokenly, and he shared with me the joy of his work. What I'd like to show you are just some images that will be again behind Carlos while he speaks, and Carlos can speak about whatever he wants. I'm not going to ask him questions. Just a moment. I will say that those of you who may have been in Houston or Buenos Aires may have seen the fabulous retrospective of his work that was done recently. 5 years ago, you couldn't find a decent book on any of these artists, hardly, except maybe Fontana. Because of the retrospective in Houston, you now have this. And it is published by Houston. It's called Color in Space and Time. It tells you almost everything you want to know. And also, both Julio and Carlos have their own websites, and I encourage you to go there. There will be other links up on our website soon. But with no further ado, I would like to introduce Carlos Cruz Diaz, and he will talk to us about his art and what he has impassioned him for half a century. Carlos?
Bueno, toda mi trayectoria desde muy jovencito lo que me ha interesado siempre es el color.
During my whole trajectory, all that has interested me has been color.
Y desde muy joven en la escuela me preguntaba por qué todo el mundo tiene que pintar de la misma manera.
And since I was in school, I always wondered why everyone draw the same way.
La única revolución que se me ocurrió, la revuelta, era no pintar más con óleo, sino con wash.
The only revolution that occurred to me at that time was to not paint anymore with oil painting, but with wash.
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 Wash. Acuarela, pues. Y eso me toda la vida lo he tenido, puesto que lo que me interesó desde la escuela fue el momento en que ponía el color sobre la tela. Me gustaba dibujar también, pero lo más emocionante para mí era poner el color sobre la tela.
It's something that has always been with me, that always interests me. And since I was little, for me the most important was to paint and to put color on a canvas.
Pero y otra cosa que me di cuenta es que el color, uno hablaba de un color rojo o verde, pero cambiaba continuamente. Y en mi ciudad, de donde nací, en Caracas, hay un problema atmosférico muy bello debido a los vientos alisios.
Something that I noticed is that people always talk about a red or a green, but it's never the same red or green. It's always it's changing. And there's a phenomena in Caracas where I lived is during the day there was a time where strong winds came.
El color, la atmósfera de Caracas cambia continuamente de color.
And that made the atmosphere change continuously.
Igual fenómeno lo encontré cuando llegué a París.
I found the same phenomena when I arrived in Paris.
Y una vez fui al llano venezolano y hay un fenómeno en el mes de agosto que cuando la humedad es muy grande, el sol al ponerse, al bajar en la tarde, todo se vuelve naranja intenso, casi rojo.
Once I went to the Venezuelan plains, and there's a phenomenon in August when the humidity is at its highest, and the sun is going down, the whole landscape becomes like this intense orange.
Eso me daba la información de que el color estaba en el espacio, no tenía que estar sobre un soporte, era el aire que estaba coloreado. Las árboles que eran verdes se habían vuelto naranja, es decir que el color no estaba sobre el soporte, estaba en el espacio.
That taught me that color wasn't what was in space, wasn't on objects, like the air was colored, and even the trees that were supposed to be green were colored by the light and they were orange.
El haber tenido esa inquietud y esa información no significó que pudiera estructurar un discurso con lo que había experimentado.
After having that information, it didn't mean that I had an artistical speech yet.
Tenía yo una preocupación de que al entrar a la escuela, cuando le dije a mi padre que yo quería ser artista, se hizo muy feliz, fue muy contento, pero me dijo algo que me quedó en la memoria.
I was worried when I told my father that I wanted to. At first, I was worried to tell him that I wanted to study arts, but actually, he was very supportive. But he told me something that stayed in my head forever.
Me dijo, el ser artista es algo muy sumamente serio, de una extrema gravedad. No es una diversión, es un compromiso con la sociedad y contigo mismo.
To be an artist, it's a really serious matter. It's a serious matter. It's not just something to play with. And you have a compromise now with yourself and with society now.
Y no debes olvidar que yo soy de una generación donde en la época estábamos influenciados, éramos muy politizados, porque hubo el movimiento del realismo mexicano, del muralista mexicano.
And you must not forget that I'm from another time frame where art was influenced by political movements, especially one called the Mexican realism.
Y lo que pensábamos era que el arte tenía que revelar lo que estaba ante nuestros ojos. Pensaba que el artista debía ser como un reportero.
And we thought that art was to reflect what was happening at the moment, and the artist was like a journalist.
Denunciar lo que estaba ante mis ojos para tratar de modificar una situación política y económica.
It has to denounce what was happening at the moment politically wise.
pero lo que resultó fue un fracaso muy grande, porque pintar la miseria no era darle solución a la miseria.
But it was a big failure because to paint misery, it wasn't giving a solution to misery.
Durante muchos años hice una pintura que se llamó en la época Realismo Socialista.
During a period of time, I painted socialistic reality.
Y el único resultado que tuve que me hizo entrar en dudas y cambiar de ruta fue que esas obras no cambiaban las dificultades económicas, sino que al exponerlas en el museo, a las dos horas se vendían.
What made me change my mind is that I thought I was denouncing the bad political situation, but when they were exposed in museums, they were instantly sold in 2 hours.
Y me las compraban los mismos que yo pensaba que provocaban la pobreza.
And the people that bought the paintings were the people that he thought that were creating poverty and misery.
Y ahí fue donde dije, bueno, tengo que cambiar, tengo que buscar otro camino, porque o me he equivocado o estoy haciendo el payaso.
Then I thought that I really have to change my speech because, like, or I got it wrong or I'm a clown.
Eso fue un largo camino. Me tomó muchos años estructurar un discurso basado en la experiencia que tuve del color en el espacio. Cómo estructurarlo, cómo decirlo y cómo transformarlo en un discurso.
It was a long way to develop a structured speech about how to bring color into space.
Eso me dediqué a buscar entre los que habían, qué se había dicho sobre el color, tanto los científicos, los filósofos, los artistas y la tecnología de la multiplicación de la imagen.
I had to do a long research about what had been said about color at that time, what artists, scientists, and philosophers had said about color at that time.
Hasta que al fin encontré un día por el conocimiento, la experiencia y el azar van juntos.
And then I realized that knowledge and experiment and art come together.
Yo me ganaba la vida como grafista, como diseñador.
Before I earned money working as a graphist and designer.
Una noche estaba terminando un catálogo para la Orquesta Sinfónica de Nueva York que se presentaba en Caracas.
One night I was finishing a catalog for the Symphonic Orchestra of New York that was doing a concert in Caracas.
Y yo había hecho una página roja y una página blanca al frente.
I had made a red page and in front of it a white page.
Y cuando estaba hojeando el catálogo, la maqueta, vi que la página blanca se coloreaba de rojo.
And when I was going through the pages, I saw suddenly that the red page was being reflected on the white page. It was painting the white page red.
Mientras más la acercaba, más se hacía más roja. Y mientras la alejaba, se hacía rosa.
More I put the red sheet near the white sheet became redder, and when I put it farther away, the white sheet became more pink.
Y allí asociando la experiencia anteriores de la realidad de la naturaleza con esa, puse a punto una lectura indirecta.
And connecting that experience with the one on the plains with the natural change of light, I developed a
una lectura indirecta.
An indirect lecture.
Porque la pintura, el arte, nuestra lectura del arte es perpendicular del ojo al plano de color.
Our art, when we see art, we see it in a perpendicular way. It's directly from the eye straight to the art piece.
Si lo hacía de reflejado, tendría el color en el espacio. Entre la distancia que había entre las dos páginas, creaba un espacio coloreado que no estaba en el soporte.
If I played with the reflections, I could create the illusion that the color was colorating, the color was in the space, was the air was colored.
Eso fue la estructura, muy simple dicho, pero eso fueron años de experiencia, de fracasos y de logros.
I'm saying it pretty simply now, like it's an obvious thing, but it actually was long years of experimenting and searching and a lot of failures.
Hasta que al fin, el año 59, estructuré mi discurso para, y que es lo que ustedes conocen hoy en día.
And finally, in the year 1959, I came to finally develop a structured speech, and that's the speech that you guys know now.
Y mi inquietud social que tuve para denunciando la pobreza, lo he transformado en el discurso actual, que es integrar el arte a la calle.
And beginning with a speech of denouncing poverty, now became integrating art to the streets.
Es porque otra de las cosas que me daban dudas como artista era que toda la angustia, toda la emoción y toda la intención intelectual de un artista terminaba colgado sobre un clavo.
What made me doubt a lot about myself is that all the doubts and beliefs and hard efforts made by artists ended up hanging by a nail.
Por eso pensé que el soporte de la calle sería una comunicación, que la gente pudiera ser parte de la obra, es decir, que la obra no fuera sino compartida. Que no fuera yo solo, sino que la gente contribuyera a hacerlo.
That's why using the street as a support, I thought that it would make people participate in the art piece, that it would be a sort of communication.
En lugar de decirle que era pobre, lo hacía participar de una experiencia espiritual y afectiva como es el arte y como es el color.
Instead of saying to people that they were poor, actually I was making them participate and make them understand an art piece.
Y he podido convencer a promotores y para hacer obra en la calle, porque creo que el futuro de los artistas, el soporte del futuro de los artistas es la calle.
And I have been talking with promoters for art pieces in the street, because I believe that the future of an artist is art in the street.
Porque las grandes ciudades que se han creado es una nueva situación que el hombre está viviendo, porque un siglo, dos siglos atrás, el hombre vivía en el campo, hoy vive en las grandes concentraciones.
Centuries ago, people lived in the countryside, and today people live in big agglomerations.
Y en esas grandes concentraciones, el hombre no tiene ninguna respuesta de la calle. Uno en la calle se convierte en un robot, en un autómata.
And today people are numbed by the street. When people are walking on the street, they become like robots.
Si uno creara situaciones en ciertos lugares de la ciudad, podría despertar, darle un mensaje al espíritu y despertarlo de esa actitud robótica que tenemos al atravesar un paso peatonal.
And by putting a situation in the street, by putting a situation on the street like an art piece, I thought that it would awaken people out of that robotic behavior.
Y por eso he tratado de dar muchos soportes al discurso del color para sacarlo del clavo colgado de la pared.
And that's why I support the color speech, because I wanted to get out of the thought of that it has to be hanging from a nail.
Y yo, como ustedes verán, yo he intervenido los aeropuertos, el piso, los techos, las paredes, todo es posible que sea soporte para decir un discurso sobre el color, que es un mundo afectivo.
And as you can see, I have intervened in airports and museums and banks and many public places to support the idea that color is an effective thing.
He dicho.
That's it.
Muchísimas gracias. Do you see why I wanted these artists to be here? Because they're not just idly sitting by and saying, well, I can do this and make some money or whatever. They're just wonderful people, and their art conveys what wonderful people they are, and they share it with everyone, anyone who's interested. I picked a few pictures. Carlos was not addressing them, but I thought it might be appropriate to end his section of the program with this image because he designed a chromatic environment for a theater. Can you imagine if you were able to sit in seats that looked like this and looked at a curtain, you know, the theater curtain that looked like this? It doesn't have to be imitation Baroque red velvet. So, at this point, I'm afraid that I'm a poor substitute for Esther Lita Brodsky, who has organized, currently, if you're going to New York, be sure you stop by the New York University Gray Art Galleries. They're not spacious venue, but she's done a historic retrospective of his work, limited by size to some extent. But if you want to see an excellent source on their website, go see the show. And she's done a really great catalog. She is a world expert on Soto. And I want to thank the family, the artist's widow, Hélène. The artist widow Hélène Soto in Paris, who lent us the marvelous penetrable, blue penetrable that's in our exhibition, and also daughter Florence, son Cristobal, one of the granddaughters I hope may have made it to the program. She had to work late tonight and drive in from Dulles Airport, so I hope she's here to hear this, and she can tell me everything that I say that's wrong, I hope, because I've long been a fan of Soto's work, and we have a good collection here. One of the things that I like about all of the artists in the show, Soto's the first one I encountered when I was before I was even a graduate student, and I was fascinated because it seemed like it was such a structured work, and yet it was full of movement and energy and sometimes a sense of humor. And it's created in ways that he uses thin parallel lines, usually black and white, sometimes blue, and I'm showing you his homage to Yves Klein, because when Soto came to Paris, one of the artists he met was Yves Klein, and Yves Klein was noted for many things, among them a certain kind of very rich blue, which became known as Klein blue. And so this is Soto's homage or homage to Yves Klein. I'm not going to do, none of these talks are about a biographical summary of each of the artists, but I thought there are a couple of works that help transmit a little bit what he was achieving. When he first arrived in Paris in 1950, he was essentially a self-taught artist. He had studied in Caracas, but he set about very methodically to learn, and he was very inspired by certain artists, older, younger, some he knew in Paris, some he didn't, but among them were Mondrian, Joseph Albers, Naum Gabo, Moholy-Nagy, Calder. You get the idea. He is interested immediately by abstraction, by dynamism, by visual and spatial effects. One of the things he determined was that he wanted to create abstract art that was akin to music. And it's an analogy that's often made between modern art, especially abstract art, is that you could appreciate music without having a subject or a story, a narrative or symbolism. And so why can't art? It's a fundamental tenet since the 1920s. But what he set about doing was, by the 1950s and 1960s, that initial utopian fervor that underlay a lot of the early abstraction had become a more formalized approach, more sophisticated, but perhaps less accessible to some audiences. And so he set about, and these are quotes from him, that in searching in his art, he was looking for universalism, and pure structure in abstraction. And to achieve that, he said, quote, one has to depersonalize. The individual no longer counts. He then concluded the next step in his process was that repetition is the first step in depersonalization. He then became very impassioned by atonal music, discovering the works of Schoenberg, and also a series of concerts of contemporary music that were organized by Pierre Boulez in Paris from the early 50s through to the early 70s. And so he turned to the idea of, in music, the idea of progressions, cyclical progressions, various kinds, and I have to confess, I don't understand atonal music. So I'm not going to attempt to make a one-to-one connection between his methods of using lines and rods and certain abstract geometric shapes. But he was seeking, as he said, quote, progression is a variant of repetition, but with non-absolute value. I'm now going to put into my words what I got from his very methodical, structured approach. And that is, I got instability, question everything, and I got it through looking at works like this one from the 1960s. There's the whole view on the left, and then there's a detail on the right. It's very simple. Horizontal black and white lines painted on a canvas, freehand for the most part, but still quite rigorously measured. And then hanging, suspended in front of it, are a series of vertical metal rods, which are not completely horizontal. They're slightly curved. And they, even when they don't move, as they simply cannot move in a picture, can you, in the upper part of this, really in any part of it, follow an entire rod without it breaking up into dots and dashes like Morse code? In person, it's almost impossible to do. You can focus and focus and focus your eyes, but it doesn't happen. And then when it, with a breath of air, or heaven forbid, someone touches it and sets it in motion, they start to go crazy. These dots and dashes, some of them will freeze. They'll move from left to right and back and forth again. You begin to wonder whether you're really seeing something that's really there or not, because how could you be seeing dots when they're solid lines? And so that kind of challenge, you know, what is real and what isn't, is what I got from his very methodically, carefully worked out, structured approach to art. Along with each of the artists in this exhibition, certainly Le Parc and Cruz Diaz, they had various moments of attention in the 1960s, which is why the Hirshhorn has a good collection of Soto, for example, because Joe Hirshhorn was buying in the 60s and he happened to see Soto. I'm showing you here just a historic photograph from the 33rd Venice Biennial in 1966. And, you know, it's a rather rarefied venue. Anyone can get into Venice Biennial, but of course you have to get to Venice first. But what happened was is it opened the door for a number of commissions. This is a photograph of a corner mural. You can see it's actually been removed from its original place, which is why it's standing there in a warehouse. But you can see he took a corner and he made it into a curve, and he illuminated with lights inside it from top to bottom. And there's a space between the rods that are hanging from above and the rods that are standing up from below. What happens then is the same thing. As you walk by this corner in a building, in an office, in a whatever, you start seeing what isn't there and wondering if what you are seeing really is solid or not, whether it's in depth or flat. He went on to doing other public spaces, such as this work at the Montreal World's Fair in 1967, which apparently I saw but don't remember at a tender age. But this gives you, and I apologize for the quality of the photograph, but this gives you an idea of some of the commissions. Soto was more fortunate in getting commissions early on, but each of the artists in this show, as you saw some of the photos for Cruz Diaz, but also when you look into what Le Parc is doing these days, go to his website and see what you see what he's doing on an obelisk in Buenos Aires. You see what the same idea of what Carlos Cruz Diaz was talking about, is bringing art into the streets, bringing what can be that sort of dismal industrial urban environment with kind of blah modern architecture. architecture and do something to liven it up, to make it more colorful, and in this case also actually physically moving, dancing in a way. This is the work that laid the groundwork for the piece that's in our show. This was an exhibition in Paris in 1969. You can see this overhead structure, which exists. It's, you know, it's an excellent geometric structure in itself, but exists to suspend these nylon cords, which this is outdoors. It covered 400 square meters, so it blew in the breeze. People walked through it. You can see that. I love this, the lady with her pet dog, and then the very nice bourgeois matron with her Queen Elizabeth handbag stopping to feel these wonderfully soft nylon cords. This is one that he did just a few years later. It's one of the few that I have a color picture of. But you can see, again, the outdoor idea of an overhead structure over an open space. In it, there happens to be grass. You can barely make out a few people in there. There's a tree. And so it's really bringing this idea of a structured space that is completely in motion. It is what you want it to be. You can stand still and experience just the solitude of being in a colored, soft space that caresses you as you stand and walk through it. You have the changing light here of sunlight. That brings us to these are the penetrable series. And while the first ones were created, as you see, back in the late 1960s, they tended to be large, unique installations like the Fontana Neon that did not survive. But gradually, this is the first penetrable, the blue penetrable from 1999 that was lent to us for the show. This is it as it was seen in Los Angeles at MoCA. You can just see at the left a person moving through it. Do you see how the person becomes kind of like misty? It's not just that they're hidden by the cords, it's that they seem to become translucent. So what you think is there isn't quite what it should be when your eyes look at it. But I think more interestingly, this is obviously a professional photograph where you've got lovely people doing lovely things, but when you go through it, but this is exactly what happens, though, is people go through, and some just go blithely through it. Some, I'm a claustrophobe, so I kind of have to take a deep breath before I plunge in. Other people find that, oh, they want to suddenly turn around and go backwards or go out the side. They're next to someone. They don't know that they're next to someone, and then they emerge from it. And it's, to me, I've been observing just in the little bit since the show has been up, is that a lot of people turn around and go right back in. So this idea that their perceptions augmented by a sense of touch, there's a sensuous, not just sensory, but a sensuous aspect to it. It's also a work intended to go outdoors. I'd love to see it one day in the Hirshhorn Museum's garden or plaza, but we'll see if that's even remotely possible. And I'm showing here two works that he would make. These are also structures, one indoors, one out, in which he creates compositions, geometric compositions, out of nylon and sometimes colored aluminum. And rather than attempt to convey what that's like, I'm now going to show the video, which gives you, not only lets you see the artist himself. Yes? Okay. But I have to show it. Sorry, I know we're out of time, but this is really good. Sorry. I'm going to be bad just this once.
C'était plutôt la couleur, l'espace, comment jouer avec la couleur. Et tous ensemble social dans la participation, commencer à se faire sentir. Et pourtant, le pénétrable, c'est une conséquence. Mais en même temps, le pénétrable garde aussi cette idée d'envelopper l'onde, d'envelopper, de lui démontrer qu'il est une partie constituante de l'espace.
Would you like to have one of those outside your office? So that's why I wanted to share the video. I'm sorry we are running long, but I thought that says more than words does. I'm a little unfair now because I've left it to Alma to talk about OET Sika in a very short period of time, but what she has to show you is worth the wait. So Alma, you want to come up?
Okay, so this is the last artist that we're going to be talking about tonight, and I think that maybe by now you have noticed certain similarities, perhaps not in the way the work looks, but in the thinking that this artist had, the idea of these a relationship of power, you know, trying to break down this power relationship between the artist and the institution was one of them. The idea of, you know, not working only in formal terms, but also in social terms. You know, their work was formal and it was social. They needed to communicate with a larger audience. Not the audience that came to museums exclusively, but the audience that was, you know, on the street. Also, another important thing is that they, for me, they created magic. And all this was created with such simple elements, you know, two lights and these little squares. Or, you know, like Soto with nylon strings, or like Fontana with neon. I mean, everything was so simple. And so low-tech, and I did ask Julio Leparque when I interviewed him in Los Angeles whether he would like to recreate the works that he made back then with more contemporary equipment, or, you know, for example, I don't know, use a projector instead of a light. And for him, you know, he said that it was important to remain faithful to the elements, not because he couldn't use new technology, but because he thought it was not necessary, that what he could do with simple elements. And it was important for him that technology didn't surpass the effect, that what people experienced was the most important aspect of the work. So if he could attain that with two lights, you know, and little squares hanging, that was enough for him. So here we have the last artist, Elio Itizica, who was born in Rio de Janeiro. Elio lived a very short life. I mean, he was about 41, 42 when he passed away, but during that brief period, he accomplished a lot. The work that we have in the exhibition is actually a collaboration, but before I get to that point, I want to show you what he did. This is in 1969 when he was invited to do an exhibition in London, and he at the Whitechapel Gallery, and he called it the Whitechapel Experience. And he is dressed in one of his parangolés, and the parangolé was a costume that he created, actually inspired by samba and the carnival in Rio. And they were meant to be worn They were meant to be danced in, and many of them had sentences, sometimes political slogans. And of course, you know, that was very much of what he wanted to do. He came from a middle-class family, an intellectual family. The grandfather was a photographer, the father was a poet, etc. But he actually eventually discovered the streets, and he incorporated the streets into his work. And that's what made him so special and so different from everyone else. He also used the word penetrable. See, this is something that this artist used quite a bit. You know, the idea of penetrating the artwork, the idea of stepping into it and becoming part of it. And this work is being modified because actually, initially, when he created this work in 1960, you could walk through it. He started as a painter, and little by little, he, like other Brazilian artists, took the painting off the wall and into the space. And this is what he did. He used color. He was very interested in color, the way Cruz Diaz was, and he also was interested in bringing the work off the wall into the space, and then eventually outside of the museum, on the streets, incorporating street elements, popular elements into it, and making it very approachable, making it very comfortable for people to participate and understand. There is a wonderful article by Mario Pedrosa, a Brazilian critic who wrote extensively about Oiticica and many of the artists of the time, in which he talks about how Oiticica discovered the streets, you know, and he said, well, Oiticica opened the doors of his studio and he walked down and to the metro station, and suddenly he was in the middle of the street and he discovered this new world, and then he couldn't but take it in and make it his own. And so he did. You know, he was very interested in the favelas, which are the shanty towns in Rio. He lived in the favelas. He was very good friends with many of the people who lived there. Many of them wore these costumes, these parangoles. They danced in them. And there are many pictures of these inhabitants of the favelas wearing and dancing in the costumes. And he looked at the this kind of precarious architecture that existed in those towns. And, of course, the wonderful nature, the wonderful vegetation in Rio. And he incorporated that in works like this. This is Tropicália, you know, which actually became a movement in Brazil that was not just a movement that incorporated art, but also music, literature, etc., theater. And it's the Penetrable number 2 from 1967. So he made a series of environments like this in which he created these little rooms that you could walk into. And one room had water, and you usually there's sand, and you have to take your shoes off, and then you walk in the sand and you enter one of these penetrables, and there's water. So you step into the water, and the next one there are dry leaves, and so you hear the noise of the leaves under your feet, and the next one there are little stones, and so on. So you get this sensorial experience. You know, it's not just visual, it's not just aesthetic, but it's also corporeal. And that's what he defined as suprasensorial, and that's where the title of the exhibition comes from. And then we have, this is another kind of labyrinth. These artists were very interested in the idea of the labyrinth. And he made this one using a color plastic, which is kind of interesting. And you walk through these narrow corridors, and interesting enough, in the U.S., we can't replicate this work because the corridors are so narrow that they do not meet the fire marshal regulations. And so this is a piece that I had thought for the Hirshhorn, but we couldn't do it here. And how do you modify the artwork? How, you know, the artist is no longer alive. So it's very hard to do something that he didn't intend. But here you can see how he creates these beautiful environments made with color plastic. And it was so interesting because every time you turned and you enter into a little chamber, you would find something unexpected. And at the very end, there is an orange juice machine. And you take a little glass of orange juice before you walk out of the environment. And then this is what we have here at the Hirshhorn. And in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, there was a dictatorship in Brazil, and the situation was very difficult, even for the artists. And Oiticica had applied and received and been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, so he thought that it was a good time to leave Rio and move to New York for a while. And he had been in New York before. He has spent in the 60s several years in London. He was very good friends with this art critic curator guy, Brett, who wrote extensively about him and other artists from Brazil at the time. And he loved New York, so he came to New York, and he spent actually quite a few years from 72 to 78, I think, pretty much, or 73, 78. And it was during the time in New York that he actually created these large installations, which he never saw because he passed away a few years after he returned to Brazil in 1981, and these pieces were not recreated until the 90s. So he never saw them realized. So in any case, being in New York, he was very good friends with, back in Rio, he was very good friends with a filmmaker and actor, Neville D'Almeida. And Neville had had one of his films censored by the government, and so he also felt the need to leave the country for a while, and Neville went to London. And so while Ojisika was in New York and Neville was in London, they kept in touch, and then Neville traveled to New York, and throughout a year they created 5 installations. Now they were called Cosmo Coca, Work in Progress. Neville was a filmmaker, and Ojisika was very interested in film. Actually, that's the reason why he approached Neville for the first time. He went to see one of the D'Almeida films, and he was so intrigued by it that he wanted to meet the filmmaker. So both in New York worked together. They created this 5 Cosmo Coca Work in Progress series, because and they called it Work in Progress because it was just the beginning of something. They were going to continue to work together, and so they felt that this was just part of it. But they never did. So this is what they became, but they always said every time you use the title, you have to call it Programa in Progress, or Program in Progress, because this is how we intended it to be. And this is the first one, which was called Cosmo Coca, number 1, Trash Escapes. And it's so interesting that they created this in the course of a year, as I said, from March 1973 to March 1974. And the idea was that Eliud Tisica would not play the role of the artist, he would do something else, and Neville D'Almeida was not going to play the role of the filmmaker, they were going to switch roles. And so Eliud Tisica was a tremendous note-taker. You know, he left, I don't know how many notebooks, but piles and piles of notebooks filled with notes. Really, really interesting that the family is slowly translating, and they have digitalized all the books to make them available to scholars. And little by little, we're getting to know his work more and more. And so that's quite amazing. But Ojisika wrote everything down for this particular installation that you see here, which is the one you will experience in the exhibition. He said that he made it with Neville D'Almeida, that it was a reference to cinema, that D'Almeida coined the name Cosmo Coca. He created it in his apartment on 2nd Avenue and 81st Street in New York on March 13, 1973, that the photos were taken by Elio, that the cocaine lines that you see, which he called like the makeup lines, were made by Neville D'Almeida, that the soundtrack was a montage of northeastern Brazilian music, popular music, discords used in Stockhausen, Jimi Hendrix, and Second Avenue street sounds, and that there was a male voice reading a text. That they used in the photos that Ojisika took. He took a photo of a New York Times magazine with Luis Buñuel on the cover. There was a poster by Elio Ojisika of a friend of his called Luis Fernando Guimarães wearing one of the capes, and it was cape 23, penetrable 30. So he was very detailed in that respect. That he also used the album cover of Whistles Rip My Flesh by Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, that they used cocaine, and they had assorted props in what he called the Babylonest, which was actually his apartment in New York. And then he said that the slides had to be projected simultaneously on two opposite walls, that participants had to recline on cushions and to file their fingernails, and that the soundtrack had to start 1 minute before the projection of the first slide in a chance relationship with a slide sequence. And it's interesting also that he made this was for a public performance, and then he left directions for a private performance, and he did that for each one of them. So he's telling us what to do here in a very detailed way, but at the same time, he's giving you the freedom to do in the space whatever you want. And this is very interesting because a lot of people may focus on this is an environment or this is an installation or this is about drugs, but actually this was about freedom. They both made it at the time in which their country was going through a very difficult time in which freedom was being taken away from people. So I think that the main premise of these pieces is that these are places of freedom where you can actually, you know, be yourself. This is Cosmococca 5, Hendrix War from 1974, and it's one of my favorites because you lie down in a hammock and you listen to Jimi Hendrix, you know, and you have all these images flashing. It's pretty amazing, you know, and it shows his love for music and how much he enjoyed it. And the one that we selected in Los Angeles for the exhibition is this one. And this is CC number 4, Cosmococca number 4, Negations, and actually it's an homage of John Cage. And for this one here, he said that he made it at the same address, 81st and 2nd Avenue, that he made it on August 24th, 1973, in the bathroom of the apartment. So that's kind of interesting, that he used the toilet bowl as a swimming pool to create this. And then, of course, he left a specific instructions as to what size the pool should be and all, but it initially started in the bathroom of his apartment. And that, you know, he explained exactly what it should be. As you can see here, it should be a swimming pool of a certain size and a certain depth. It should have blue lights running around the perimeter of the pool. There should be a theater light, a green theater light hanging from the ceiling, creating this beautiful a triangle on the water. And the images of John Cage's notations should be, again, you know, projected on opposite walls while the music of John Cage was playing. And so with having the space that was separate from the artwork and that could not damage any of the artwork we were able to build this swimming pool. He also specified that there should be dressing rooms, that people should get white towels, you know, when they came to swim, but they should bring their own swimsuit. And he said that there should be two kinds of people using this, and he said there would be the swimmers, people who would go into the water and enjoy it, and there would be the loafers. He called them loafers, people who would just lie down on these pillows, you know, and pass the time. So here you see exactly what we were able to recreate, and Neville D'Almeida is still alive, and he came to Los Angeles, so we benefited from his knowledge and his memories of all these pieces, because as I said, even though they were created in 1973, they were not built until the 90s, and this piece has only been done three times, one in Basel, Switzerland, once in Sao Paulo, and then Los Angeles. So it was also interesting to see our audience use the swimming pool and understand that after they had gone through this experience in which they began to look at the art and suddenly they progressed through Julio's, you know, light environment and then through Carlos's color installation, and then they had to walk through the penetrable. They came to a place where they could actually take their clothes, jump into the water, and basically experience art inside, you know, in the water. And of course, you know, the water was heated, it was filtered, it was clean. People were able to stay as long as they wanted. We had a lifeguard because the state of California will not allow you to have a swimming pool without a lifeguard. And this was an amazing experience for the lifeguards because they had never actually been in a museum, worked in a museum, you know, had a work in a pool in a museum, so that was really nice. And here you can see another image of some of the people who came to use it. And we kept a tally of how many people used it, and We had repeats, and we had an 11-year-old who decided he wanted to have a birthday party in the pool and didn't tell anyone about it. The museum didn't know. So it was kind of an interesting dynamic that we would find our, you know, this kind of situations, things happening in the pool, friends getting together on a Friday afternoon, you know, swimming before going to dinner, you know, a little boy having a birthday party. But it all went along with what Oiticica really envisioned these places to be, you know, the places for recreation, places for communication, for communal living, for communal experiences. So it really, I think it really accomplished its mission. So I think this might be the last slide. Yes, that is the last slide of the evening, and I want to thank everyone, and I hope that you will now go into the... No, no. I know. So I just hope that the next time you come to the Hirschhorn and you go through the exhibition, you'll sort of look at it in a different way. I'd understand that all these works mean nothing unless you actually participate, because you, as the spectator, as the viewer, as the participant, complete the artwork. So thank you so much. There are no time for questions, I'm sorry, but I think it's time for all of us to go. Bye.